And joining us on the book club on Perspectives, the first half of the show, is Daniel Golden. Daniel is a Pulitzer Prize winner for his Wall Street Journal series on admissions preferences at elite colleges, which became the basis of his best-selling book, The Price of Admission. He's also edited a series about how U.S. companies dodge taxes by moving their headquarters overseas, which won Bloomberg News first and only Pulitzer Prize in 2015. In 2011, he was named a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for Public Service for his Bloomberg News series about for-profit colleges exploiting veterans, low-income students, and the homeless. And he's currently a senior editor at ProPublica. And the book that we're going to discuss today is Spy Schools: How the CIA, FBI, and Foreign Intelligence Secretly Exploit America's Universities. Daniel, thank you so much for being with us here today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Now, tell us a little bit about, as a child growing up, were you always interested in books and history? And based on what you've written about, were you interested in, like, kind of the secret agent, 007, stuff like that?
Yeah, I was very interested in books growing up. You know, my parents were both professors at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, and my father was an English professor, so you know, I read novels from a pretty early age, and I particularly enjoyed the spy novels, Eric Ambler and John le Carré. You know, I mean, to me, the greatest thing about this book is that the John le Carré praised it as timely and shocking, and
said,
you know, every teacher and parent and student should read it, because I love his stuff. And you know, I think it shaped my perspective a little bit, because unlike, say, the you know, the James Bond books, where you had good guys and bad guys, the Le Carré perspective was kind of moral equivalence. You know, the English Secret Service and the Russian Secret Service were both manipulating people and causing problems. And that's the perspective of this book, you know, that it's a two-way street on American campuses. You know, both domestic and foreign intelligence services are, you know, acting covertly in questionable ways. So I think that my early experience with Le Carré in particular kind of led me ultimately to the perspective I took on this book.
And as far as going on and writing about something like this, when you, because of your background and because of your interest in spy novels, and of course, Le Carré, you can't go wrong with him. When he gives you this great praise, it's a big, big feather in your hat. And I want to know a little bit about, especially with what we're hearing now, you know, with the election, the Russians hacking, what's going on with North Koreans. Did that make it, well, it does. I mean, as John le Carré say, it's very timely. When you were writing this, when did you start working on this?
Well, I really started working on this around 2014, I would say, and I mostly finished it before the you know, the presidential election. So some of what's come out is since I did my research, but it is definitely timely in a few ways. I mean, one is, you know, I document quite a bit of Russian espionage on American campuses, and of course, you know, Russian spying in the campaign has become a huge issue, and some of the Russian spying was, you know, on cyber attacks or social media, but some of it was the kind of old-fashioned human espionage I describe of, you know, people linked to Russian intelligence, meeting with, you know, Trump campaign officials and all that. And then another way it's timely is that, you know, the big issue of the last year or two in American and world politics has really been globalization versus nationalism, you know, where you've got this a sort of nationalistic backlash, which has come up in the Trump campaign, Brexit, the French presidential campaign. It's kind of a worldwide issue. And it's real. This is kind of a case study of it. You've got these very global institutions, the universities, with, you know, a million foreign students coming every year, and hundreds of thousands of foreign students and professors, and study abroad programs and branch campuses all over the world. And then you've got these intelligence agencies with kind of their narrower nationalistic agenda coming in and trying to exploit the global institutions for their own purposes. So it's kind of, to me, it taps right into, you know, the zeitgeist of America today.
What kind of students, what kind of people are these agencies looking for?
Well, it's you know, it depends, but I mean, I think that they're looking for people who are often in cutting edge scientific fields, you know, where they can provide information about, say, a, you know, weapons program in a given country is important, and then you know people are bilingual or trilingual and can, you know, move among different groups easily. So those kind of things. I mean, it sort of depends. Example of the sort of specialty aspect in terms of research, I write about how the CIA set up these sort of fake academic conferences in kind of neutral European countries to and tried to lure Iranian nuclear scientists to them in order to try and slow the Iran from developing a nuclear bomb. So you've got these kind of academic conferences. They would set them up. It's hard to recruit an Iranian nuclear scientist in Tehran, so you tailor the conference to their interests, get them to it, and then the U.S., the CIA officers would, you know, approach them and kind of pressure them to defect to the U.S. So that's an example of, you know, the particular scientific bent to their interest and how far they'll go to try and get those scientists.
And as you just mentioned also earlier, the fact that we, from reading a spy novel or watching a Bond movie, we get the impression of the old cloak and dagger method. But what you describe in your book is completely different from the traditional cloak and dagger. Now we're looking at, as you'd mentioned, what's going on in the classroom, the research, what this student is very good at or not good at, etc.
Yeah, I mean, it's still covert, and they're still often using false identities to recruit people. But I think it is, in a way, the kind of thing of Le Carre, except that it's not in a, you know, war situation where there's a personal physical risk right there. You know, instead it's a process of you know, cultivating informants and gathering information. And universities are pretty easy places to do that. I mean, they're relatively open. You know, you can walk into a seminar or a conference or an auditorium or a cafeteria or a library and sit next to somebody and strike up a conversation and you know, lie about who you are, where you come from, and you're probably going to be accepted, you know, as being legit. So it doesn't carry the same physical danger, but some of the same tactics are still used.
One of the things that we've been hearing a lot lately in the news with the current administration about restrictions of allowing people to come into this country or leave the country. And currently, there has been especially a lot of controversy, not controversy, but it's been covered a lot in the news media about whether we should let foreigners, including students, researchers, professors from hostile countries, come into the United States.
Yeah, I mean, I believe in globalization and in kind of open borders in that sense. You know, we'd become insular and parochial, and we'd fall behind if we don't know what, you know, great minds from other parts of the world are thinking and doing, and don't, you know, collaborate with them. But we just have to be smarter about it. You know, we if we're collaborating with Chinese researchers, we ought to have, you know, a written agreement that spells out, you know, what we're going to share and what aren't we going to share. You know, I tell the story of the Chinese graduate student at Duke and the, who kind of poached Pentagon-funded research on invisibility and cloaking our weapons. And, you know, he took advantage of that open culture. And, you know, there was no collaboration agreement. There wasn't that much emphasis on intellectual property. And, I mean, I just think that if we're smarter about it, then we don't have to resort to banning people, which is probably counterproductive.
What about what is currently going on? And what I mentioned is the Trump administration, and there are different things that the Trump administration is looking at doing or not doing. And then, of course, both sides, liberal and conservatives, are looking at these situations. And one of them would be, and mentioned in your book, as far as canceling the Iranian nuclear agreement, that it will spur Iran to resume building a bomb, to which the CIA will likely react by staging more academic conferences in hopes of luring scientists to come into the United States?
Yeah, I mean, my expertise doesn't extend to whether the Iran nuclear deal is a good deal or a bad deal. You know, I'm not an expert on that, but I do, you know, as I mentioned, I do show one strategy that the CIA used before there was the agreement to try and prevent Iran from developing a bomb, namely, you know, staging these fake conferences so they could, you know, drain nuclear scientists out of the Iranian program. And I mean, you know, I think it did succeed to some degree in getting some defectors from the Iranian nuclear program. I mean, how long you can keep doing that is, you know, open to question. I mean, I don't think Iran would probably tolerate it indefinitely and let its scientists keep going to conferences in other countries. So, you know, I think that those are the kind of, you know, if this agreement goes by the wayside, certainly our intelligence services, you know, Iran's development of nuclear weapons will again become a front burner issue instead of a, you know, back burner issue. And, you know, my own personal view, but just as a citizen without, you know, being an expert on it, is all the other countries involved seem to think this agreement is working pretty well and can be monitored. So and I'm not quite sure why we want to pull out of it. But if we do, I think, you know, the intelligence services will probably again play a bigger role in trying to prevent Iran from becoming a nuclear power.
And it seems we see it all the time, whether it be on a Bond show, whether it be the USA television series, Covert Affairs, where you have this conference in the United States and these officials come in from a hostile country and all of a sudden they decide to stay here or vice versa. And from there they snowball. And of course, you know, that's what the side of Covert Affairs that people see and imagine, not realizing that there's a lot more going on, as you have found out through your research and your writing. And, you know, I want to point out that, of course, what you're writing is not fiction. It's not a novel, but it's something that, as John Le Carre mentioned, very timely and very shocking. And I think anyone who has a child in school, or if you're going to school or work at a school, that you should probably read this book. It's Spy Schools, How the CIA, FBI, and Foreign Intelligence Secretly Exploited America's Universities.
Thank you so much. I couldn't put it better. I think it's a compelling book and a fun read and all factual and true. So I hope people take a look.
And Daniel, one more thing. Do you have a Facebook page or a web page that people can go to find out more about your other books and your other works and also more about this book in particular?
Certainly. Obviously, they could buy this one on Amazon or Barnes & Noble. And then I have a website, www.danlgolden.com. That's DanlGolden. And find more information about me and my other work there.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us here today. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
We've been visiting with Daniel Golden. Daniel is the author of the book Spy Schools, How the CIA, FBI, and Foreign Intelligence Secretly Exploited America's Universities. Again, thank you, Daniel, for being with us.
Thanks.
Perspectives will continue right after this. And joining us on the second half of the book club on perspective is Elaine Adams. Elaine is, she's an award-winning author, but there's a very interesting way she got into writing, at least the Raven God and the Orkney trilogy. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. But Elaine grew up in a Quaker town of Whittier in Southern California. I believe that's the same area where President Nixon grew up, isn't it?
Absolutely. He went to my high school.
Ah, okay. A long time before you, though, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. But anyway, I was mentioning the fact that you got into writing, but before that, you've always enjoyed writing, correct, since you were a young child?
Always wanted to be a writer. I didn't do it for a long time, but from the time I was very young, I knew I wanted to be a writer, but I made the mistake of asking my brother what he thought about me majoring in English in college, and he thought that was very impractical. He said, what would you do to make money? You know, so, I don't know, it kind of scorched my dream for a few years, but I did finally arrive there.
But what happened there, from what I understand, is Your family, I guess, sort of convinced you to major in accounting to help them out with the family business?
Yeah, absolutely. I ended up majoring in business and got my CPA license and came back to work in a family business for a long time. And, you know, it was a really great experience, but, I would constantly find myself drifting. You know, they talk about left brain, right brain, right? They don't really talk about being both brained. And my problem was I was really good, you know, right brain for a while. I could be, you know, very analytical. I could do all of the books and the CFO. Our business was growing pretty rapidly. But then I'd get bored, and pretty soon my left brain would take over, and all of a sudden, you know, I'd find myself having no interest in the numbers, and I would drift away for a while, and I would write a book. And then, you know, I wouldn't know what to do with it then, and I'd put it in a drawer, and I'd come back to running the business, and this went on for a very, very long time.
That must have been difficult, kind of, you know, you were balancing budgets, but then you were also trying to balance sort of a career, the career that was still in the closet. You were, you know, wanting to be a writer, but at the same time, you were helping out your family, and that must have been difficult.
It was sort of, I don't say heartbreaking in a way. When you always had this passion and this desire to write, you know, stories, authors are kind of, I think, born. Writers are people who grow up kind of knowing they always have these stories and these voices and these characters. And, you know, it was just really hard for me to find the path, find a reason to really pursue it because, you know, this industry, it's a very tough, you know, you get told no a lot. People criticize you all the time. And so, you know, being able, and I would allow myself, I'd go so far and then I would drift back to the business because there was a compelling reason. You know, we were growing quite large and I had a lot of responsibility, but I just never gave up on that dream. And I was really fortunate one day when I had a really special person close to me ask me to write them a book.
And that special person was your son. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I was teaching. I'd left the business by this time because I just, you know, too much time was passing by and I really had other things I wanted to accomplish. And the business was at a point where I could kind of retire from it, step away from it. So I started pursuing my other passions. I started traveling around the world with some humanitarian groups, looking at schools and education around the world. And I started teaching at a university. And I had this amazing guest speaker one day who was talking about his dreams and pursuing his dreams. And the thing that kind of held him back was not so much fear of success because he knew he could do it, but it was a sense of fear of being mediocre, and I just, like, he wouldn't be that great. He would do it, but it wouldn't be that great, and it kind of spoke to me, like, you know, that was part of what was holding me back, because I was so used to being successful, and I was so used to being accomplished, to being able to accomplish whatever goal I had, and I came home, and I told my son about it, and I was so fired up over it, and he just looked at me, and he said, you know, Mom, why don't you write me a book that I can read? And there was just something so powerful about that, Louis. I just got to tell you, it was just, you know, I'm a mom, I love my kids, but it was just, I had never thought about writing kids' books. I'd always thought I was writing, you know, sort of adult suspense novels, thriller novels. I was just going to write important big books, you know, for grown-ups. And now all of a sudden, here's my 12-year-old kid looking at me like, hey, write something for me. And it just sparked a passion project, you know, and not only did he give me the encouragement to pursue it, but he nagged me relentlessly, you know, Mom, you're going to finish it, right? Mom, you're going to do this, right? You're going to publish this, right? Mom, you're going to write the next one and the next one. So I just have to say, you know, in life, you're fortunate when you get a cheerleader or a mentor or somebody that really champions you. And usually it's the parent, you know, or the spouse. But in my case, it happened to me, my 12-year-old son.
Elaine, it doesn't happen as much anymore, but I remember, you know, it used to be a treat for me to read to my kids at night and also not just read them because they always wanted a Bible story, book story, uh-huh. And then a story from my mind, which to make up one. And so you tell those stories and, you know, your children remember that, enjoy that. So when your son asked you about this, did you already have a kind of an idea what kind of book he wanted?
I had no concept, no preconceived notion, because, again, I hadn't considered writing children's stories, but it just sparked something. And now, so what I had to do was set out and create a book that I knew he would enjoy and love. And he happened to be a fan of the, like, Percy Jackson universe, the mythology universe. And that was also something I had grown up, you know, reading through, like, even the Lord of the Rings trilogy. It was very much based on Norse mythology. And it just seemed like a great opportunity for me to combine that passion for mythology and those kinds of stories with my son's interest in them. And so, you know, I created that the trilogy, The Raven God, the third book in his series, is, you know, all based on this sort of Norse mythology, which is, you know, just is so rich with gods and goddesses and stories and creatures and magical objects that it gives authors like me a wealth of information to borrow from and adapt into our stories.
One of the things that is outstanding, and, you know, I went to your webpage and I was looking at some of those pictures, and there's one picture in particular where I guess you're speaking at a school and the children are holding up copies of the first book, The Red Sun, and you can tell that they are excited, and my gosh, they get to meet the person behind this book, the person who wrote this book. And so it's neat because you see these children excited about literacy, and I don't know about you, but it seems like we're coming back to children reading again, but for a while there, it seems like video games kind of took over our children.
Games were new, especially the handheld devices that we have now, where they're so ubiquitous. You know, you see two-year-olds with their mother's iPhone in their hand. They probably know how to use it better than the mother does. Swipe, you know, screen, enlarge, press play. I mean, it's shocking to me because my kids are just older. They just didn't quite have that. But no doubt, you know, there was just a period of time where it was so new, and it kind of did push everything else aside. But I think most parents are grounded in reality and understand that we all need, our children need boundaries, our family time needs boundaries. It's nothing wrong with having video games and TVs in our house, but just all about setting the boundaries so that children are encouraged to not only explore, you know, gaming and that stuff, but also reading and other experiences with the family, so that it's not always about that electronic device that they have, that they understand and are captured by the idea that reading is its own, you know, powerful universe of magic that is just as compelling as a video game.
We are visiting with Elaine Adams, an award-winning author, and she is the author of The Legends of Orkney, the trilogy. The third book just came out in September, The Raven God. Tell us a little bit about The Raven God without giving away too much, because perhaps not everybody has read The Red Sun, the second book.
Oh, Caliphus Rising.
Caliphus Rising, yes, and then The Raven God. So tell us a little bit about The Raven God. People may be familiar with Sam already from previous books, but I think that people reading The Raven God, it's pretty much a standalone. They don't have to know a lot more about The Red Sun or Caliphus Rising. Do you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so the interesting thing as an author, as you're trying to connect your trilogy, each story is kind of a standalone story, but you want to connect each one to the next. So in the first book, The Red Sun, we see Sam, you know, sort of learning about who he is as a character, learning that he has magic, learning that he's son of a witch and the son of a god, and sort of struggling with his identity and having to deal with this curse and save his friends. And at the end of the story, he's able to solve the first problem, which is, you know, a book is all about its character and the problem and the character trying to solve that problem. So done, he solves the problem, but then he creates a new problem. And you know, at the very end. And that's to kind of hook your reader in. They see that, oh, boy, we solved this problem, but now we've let loose some really terrible witches, you know, and now what's going to happen? So that the reader can't wait to pick up that second book. So in the second book, we see Sam having to face the consequences from his first decision to, and what he had to do to release these witches, to now defeating these witches. And, well, in order to do that, he has to really kind of turn to his dark side and make some choices, hard choices, that aren't necessarily the best choices, but the choices that he thinks he has to make. Sometimes we're faced with really difficult choices, and we don't know what to do, but we act out of the best of our ability. But in Sam's case, he's torn by these two different bloodlines that he has. So at the end of the story, he's done a couple things, you know, wrong that he really has to learn to live with. And as we get to the end of the story, we see that, yeah, he solves the problem. He defeats the witches, but now something even worse has happened, and we discover that Loki, god of mischief, has been released. And so the Raven God really picks up from that point. And now we have Sam as a character who's really gone through the worst of things and has now come out the other side. You know, when you look at the cover of the Raven God, you see Sam for the first time. All the other characters, you either see his back or you see him kind of glowering, you know, at us. But in the third book on the Raven God, you see him standing tall, looking forward, looking confident, looking like a hero. And that's what I really love about the third book, is Sam gets to really be the full-on hero now, in spite of all his flaws, in spite of all the mistakes he's made. It really helps kids to understand that it's okay to make mistakes. It's what you do with them. It's what you do going forward that matters. And Sam really picks up the pieces and tries to fix all the things that have gone wrong, and he really gets a chance to face off and show off his powers against Loki, who's up to all kinds of mischief.
I'm glad you mentioned that, Elaine, because this age group that this book is targeted at, it's a tough age for the kids because they're some of them are in the middle of being a tween and a teen, middle school. Some of them may try and find their identity. And I think in this book, you know, Sam helps them and shows them, hey, it's okay, as you mentioned, to make mistakes. You can fix those mistakes, and you just can't hide under a rock or just stay put. There are things for you to do, and you need to get out there and do them.
Exactly. And I think kids can really resonate with that message that, you know, we all make mistakes, and they can connect with the character. That's your job as an author, to get the reader to connect with the character, to identify with them, to care about them, and to cheer for them, you know, at the end of the day when they defeat the enemy or solve the problem.
And you mentioned earlier that, you know, you had a dream of perhaps writing adult novels, thrillers, but I find that I read a lot of books, especially for this show, but I find that there are a lot of young adult novels that are very good, and you see adults reading them as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a whole branch of books now that have come out that really have tried to capture that they're well-written. Like, that's really the thing, is that they're well-written with characters that are fully developed and have interesting sort of stories, and the writing is well done. And I think that the writing for the YA market has really improved, and that's why we're seeing more adults sitting down and reading those stories, because they're good stories and they're well-written.
Tell me a little bit about your thoughts about, because as we mentioned, social media is not as new as it used to be, but there are a lot of things out there, Facebook, a lot of social media places. But one of the things that has kind of introduced reading against to people are audiobooks. And you see a lot of young people and adults with earbuds or headphones, and they're not listening to music. They're listening to a book.
You know, that's very true for my son. He's 17 now, and he is a passionate reader, but he doesn't have a lot of time to read, but he has a lot of time in his car, and he makes the most of that. You know, he really, really does. He has read all the Game of Thrones books, you know, every one of them. He listens to them all on tape because he drives maybe 30 minutes to school every day back and forth, and in his spare time, before he goes to bed and things like that. He's very used to that, and, you know, I don't know if it's quite the same as reading. I'm a little torn between what it does. I do think it offers some of the same things, because as you're hearing the story, again, you're not watching a movie, you're hearing it, and those words are turning into pictures in your brain, right? Which is why reading is so important. It's turning words on the page into pictures, and you're using your imagination to see things that aren't there and may not even exist, and that's the key, I think, for human intelligence to develop, is having that really rich and vivid imagination. It allows us to solve problems, to be able to do something we've never done, to imagine things, right, that we haven't ever before imagined. So being able to have a rich imagination is important. I think that there is a further step when you read a book, because your brain is working a little harder to not only translate those meaningless symbols that are letters on the page into words and words into pictures, but audiobooks are a close second to that, I guess, because, again, your brain is still frying up with all that imagination, and it's a different way of hearing the story. Some people are very auditory anyway in their learning.
Elaine, thank you so much for being with us here today. We've been visiting with Elaine Adams. She is the author of The Legends of Orkney Trilogy, the latest book that came out in September, The Raven God. And Elaine, thank you so much also for reaching out to our young children and to reach out and help them with literacy. And I'm glad you listened to your son.
Yeah, you got it, Louie. Thanks for having me on the show today.
Thank you. We were visiting with Elaine Adams. Elaine is the author of the trilogy Legends of Orkney, the latest book, The Raven God. Perspectives is taped and produced on KTUP at the University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Alejandro Dominguez. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sainz.